From the studios of the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, comes the latest issue of Indie Week. John Federson reads this issue, dated January 22nd of 2020, for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And we will now start out with our Voices column. This one contributing writer Jonathan Weiler, who is a teaching professor in global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Shortly before the 2012 presidential election, I wrote an article asserting that regardless of who won, our democracy was broken. To be clear, I was a fervent Obama supporter against Mitt Romney. We were failing to deal seriously with some of the most pressing issues of the day, including growing inequality, inaction on the unfolding catastrophe of climate change, a metastasizing national security state, and political institutions like the Electoral College that increasingly distorted the popular will. As an undeniably consequential presidential election approaches, it's sobering to look back and see how little progress we've made, if any at all, on those issues over the past decade. And looking ahead, there's little to indicate that we're willing or able to seriously confront those and other fundamental problems in the near future. For instance, the deeply entrenched nature of racism in our society, embedded in all areas of life, including school, work, housing, and the justice system, has arguably received much more attention since 2012, partly as a result of the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. But increased, though still relatively limited, awareness aside, little has actually been done to address systemically these realities. America's prison population has fallen in recent years, including among African Americans, but America remains in the top two or three of the world's biggest jailers. And Black Americans are at least four times as likely to be imprisoned as white Americans, including for drug offenses, though there is no evidence that Blacks use at higher rates than whites. That we continue to fail to seriously address how profoundly racism structures life chances remains a fundamental stain on our country. Poverty has declined somewhat from 2012 levels, but despite the record-long expansion, the poverty rate is still higher than it was in the 1970s and in the last years of the Clinton presidency. About 12% of the population, close to 40 million Americans, live below the poverty line. And remember that the federal poverty line for a family of four is a meager $26,000 a year. As has long been true, our poverty and child poverty rates remain higher than that of virtually any other rich country. One area of meaningful improvement in American life since 2012 has been in health insurance coverage, thanks to Obamacare, flawed though it is. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, one in six non-elderly Americans were uninsured before the Affordable Care Act came into full force in 2013. 10% are now. That's still more than 25 million uninsured Americans each year, a complete outlier among wealthy countries. It is nevertheless a real accomplishment. That's especially true of the ACA's Medicaid expansion, which, despite GOP obstruction, insures millions of previously uncovered poor Americans. But the improvement in health insurance coverage is mitigated by the striking trends in life expectancy. Perhaps the clearest measure of increasing social well-being is how long people live. After steady progress for decades, life expectancy in the U.S., which has long lagged other rich countries, began to flatline about two decades ago. Then, shockingly, it actually declined between 2014 and 2017. It has ticked up very slightly since. So-called deaths of despair, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including from suicide, liver disease, and drug overdose, the latter from the opioid epidemic, which has claimed several hundred thousand lives since the late 90s, are a major cause. Strikingly, as the income and wealth gaps have continued to grow between rich and poor, so has the life expectancy gap. As a result of steady increases in life expectancy for well-off Americans, coupled with stagnation for the less well-off, the gap is now estimated to be 15 years among men and 10 years among women. This has happened in spite of remarkable breakthroughs in medical technology and treatment, including for cancer and heart disease. It's not that nothing is better. The triumph of man, triumph of marriage equality is a great achievement, of course, but the promise of the American dream, that life chances for most would improve with each passing generation, rings increasingly hollow. Unfortunately, even if we avert disaster in November, it's hard to be confident that this will change. And we move across the page to the 15 minutes segment, this featuring Angel Dozier, age 42. Thomas E. McDonald wrote this question and answer. Why did you choose to live in Durham? I have been in Durham, says Ms. Dozier, since 1999. I really wanted to move to New York City, and I had a six-year-old. I was not willing to risk putting him in an unstable environment. I decided, okay, this is kind of how I can have both worlds. To me, Durham is a little rugged and rough. I'm attracted to that because it gives me that New York feel. So I was like, I'm going to create New York in my own environment. I got a job at Duke as a researcher, and I just built that life for myself. Durham is kind of rough, but it's beautiful. I'm attracted to the urban energy. What do you have in the works for 2020? I'm working on emerging as an artist myself, doing photojournals, writing and using photographs to tell stories. I'm looking to exhibit later this year. I write all the time. I am a journalist or a diarist. I write in my journal a lot. So I'm planning on putting the writing out there as a visual art. And also in meditation app. Look at me being a 70s kid, using the things I have written to record them for meditation. What does a healthy arts community look like? It looks like everybody really pooling their talent together as a collective and rising above all our issues in a way that none of us has ever seen before, because we haven't been united before. But if I'm able to put my, whatever it is, my energy, my curatorial talents, for the sake of the community, and then, you know, the people next door to me are able to cook a dope meal or something, and the person on the other side of the hall is a great advocate for seniors, if we just take everything that we have, right where we are, we can create something that's bigger than ourselves. Just like that. Over another page to the new feature, The Good, the Bad, and the Awful. We give a good mark this week to the Arts Center. Last January, the Arts Center announced that it was pulling out as an anchor of Carborough's mixed-use 203 project, nearly a year after it signed a development agreement with the town. Arts Center Executive Director Dan Mayer said at the time that the nonprofit had decided to pursue other options that better fit our needs. Last week, we got a clearer sense of what that meant. The New Jersey-based Nicholson Foundation, a major arts center funder for almost a decade, granted the organization $1.6 million toward building its own $5.5 million facility on Jones Ferry Road. Barbara McFadden, a Nicholson trustee who is at the Arts Center board, said it's time for the Arts Center to have a home that can showcase the imagination within so that it can flourish, embrace, and inspire more members of our community. The bad button of the week, the Durham Housing Authority. From the Department of Bad Timing. Last week, news surfaced that on December 30th, 4 days before a carbon monoxide crisis forced the evacuation of McDougald Terrace, the Durham Housing Authority Board of Commissioners awarded CEO Anthony Scott a 1.5 raise, worth almost $3,000, and a $15,000 bonus, with the Performance Evaluation Committee praising Scott for rebuilding the DHA's relationships with the city and HUD. and inspiring confidence the agency could handle major rebuilding and renovation projects. Days later, the carbon monoxide crisis at McDougal Terrace blew up, bringing to the surface decades of neglect and horror stories of mold, sewage problems, and gas leaks. And the DHA had to evacuate some 300 residents to area hotels. It's spent almost $500,000 on that relocation. Finally, awful. The Raleigh Police Department. When you're telling people not to rush to judgment based on video footage, in other words, not to believe what their eyes are telling them, things have gone sideways. This is the position Raleigh Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown found herself in on Friday afternoon, defending the body cam footage the RPD had released in response to a viral video showing the brutal arrest of Braley Batista Concepcion. And yes, the footage was bad, no matter which version you saw. Officers beating, punching, and kneeing Batista Concepcion until his face was bloody and he had a black eye. As hard as the footage was to watch, Deck Brown said the blame lay with Batista Concepcion. Compliance and cooperation are so important during these types of encounters. Batista Concepcion returned to the hospital on Friday due to injuries sustained during his arrest on Tuesday. And now our longer columns. Thomas E. McDonald, news from North Carolina. Look the other way. A new report from the North Carolina Justice Center found a 48% increase in workplace deaths in North Carolina over the last decade. In addition, the report charges that the NC Department of Labor, with failing to investigate hundreds of workplace deaths, failing to adequately punish companies that break the rules, and failing to enforce state laws. Enforcement has fallen since 2012 in terms of penalties, willful violation assessments, and inspections when fatalities occur, says Alan Freyer, director of the Justice Center's Workers' Rights Project and author of Too Lax Too Often. In fact, he goes on, there's been a 900% increase in the number of fatality cases where no inspection occurred at all. While the NCDOL conducted complete or partial investigations of 459 workplace deaths and catastrophic injuries between 2012 and 2018, the report says, 499 other incidents went uninvestigated. Fryer says that could be due to the department misclassifying some workers as independent contractors, whose deaths and injuries the department does not investigate. The NCDOL denies that it misclassifies workers. Vulnerable and marginalized employees are most likely to die on the job. Disproportionately, they are people of color. Latinx workers, for example, comprise about 10% of the state's population, but accounted for 25% of workplace deaths between 2012 and 2017. They tend to perform more dangerous jobs. 70% of workplace deaths take place at construction, manufacturing, and agriculture sites. Kevin Beauregard, the director of the NCDOL's Occupational Safety and Health Division, says his staff, quote, knows all too well what anguish and long-lasting impact fatal incidents have on the workplace and the community. The Justice Center, he adds, does not present accurate or complete information when they conclude workplace deaths have exploded in North Carolina compared to the national average. The number of workplace deaths in North Carolina and nationwide fluctuates from year to year based on a number of factors outside of the NCDOL's control, he says. Still, the idea that Labor Commissioner Sherry Berry's department has sided with employers over employees is nothing new. As the News and Observer reported in December, Berry ran for office in 2000 because she was upset that the OSH had fined her company $550. Throughout her tenure, the NCDOL has shied away from penalizing employers. In April, when Berry announced that she would not seek a sixth term, She described her department as, quote, not a regulatory agency so much as we're an agency that will partner with employers and will help them achieve safe workplaces. Along those lines, the Justice Center report says the NCDOL's core philosophy is to allow employers to police themselves, quote, in exchange for voluntary compliance, NCDOL's offers lower penalties, laxer enforcement, and fewer investigations. Fryer says voluntary compliance gives too many of those violators a free pass, and it's time for the Department of Labor to step up and fully enforce the law. Significant penalties exist both to hold employers accountable and to serve as deterrents. The worse the violation, the stiffer the fine, in theory at least. But that's not always what happens. In a 2014 case cited in the Justice Center report, a worker for Delta Contracting was crushed to death. Though the NCDOL deemed the violation serious, it fined the company just $1,165. Justice Center found that the NCDOL, quote, routinely hands out exceptionally low penalties and then allows violators to negotiate their way to even lower penalties. As a result, the state's penalties for serious violations between 2012 and 2018 were more than 30% below the national average. In 2014, Freyer says the DOL handed out an average of $3,100 in penalties for violations involving workplace deaths. The national average that year was 11,000. By 2017, that gap had grown. State average, 4,177. National average, 16,481. The report also alleges that the DOL pulls punches on issuing willful violations against bad actor companies, which typically come with the steepest penalties. Most years, Justice Center says, the DOL issues only a handful of willful violations, and the department backed off full enforcement in almost two-thirds of the cases where workplace fatalities stemmed from willful violations. Beauregard points out that the burden of proof is very high for bad actor violations. One point of agreement between the Justice Center and the DOL, the department has too few inspectors. Last year, the DOL relied on 97 inspectors, or one for every 44,600 employees and every 2,500 businesses in the state. With that number, it would take the department 108 years to inspect every site in the state. Beauregard says the division could use additional resources to reach more employers. The OSH, quote, has had difficulties over the past several years filling vacant compliance officer positions and retaining compliance officers, primarily due to available funding for salaries. The DOL, Beauregard says, has voiced its concerns to both state and federal lawmakers. And we turn the page to Raleigh News, this column by Leah Taus. The ground beneath them. Willie Stokes lives on a fixed income. His grandmother bought his Maple Street bungalow in the 1920s when College Park was a black neighborhood, self-sufficient with its own businesses and culture. But when Stokes, 76, inherited the home in 2003, the neighborhood was crawling with drugs and crime. He'd wake up to find litter on the sidewalks and spent his morning walks scooping it up. Nobody would be cleaning up, sweeping in the streets, but it was in my blood, Stokes says. I didn't like seeing the trash all around. Since the city started buying homes in the neighborhood, he's been on the front lines of another transformation. Across the street sits one of the city's affordable homes, valued for tax purposes at $262,000. Next door, there's a two-story home built in 2018. That's already valued on the tax rolls at nearly double its $222,000 sales price. Stokes' house hasn't changed much since he's lived there. But because his neighborhood is becoming so much pricier, the government views the land underneath it as much more valuable. In fact, Since the last time Wake County assessed property values 4 years ago, the value of his land has more than tripled from $37,500 to $132,250 as of last week. In 2016, the county decided to assess property values every 4 years instead of eight. This would normally mean a 50% hike in local property taxes from about $585 per year to about $877. Stokes is fortunate. He qualifies for the state's senior tax relief program and won't see much of a change. But just 1% of city property owners qualify for this tax break. Many of his neighbors don't, and the county's revaluation could hit them hard. Overall, Wake's appraisals increased property values by about 20%, but the changes were unevenly distributed. Neighborhoods east of downtown Raleigh saw staggering increases driven by redevelopment. Modest homes were gobbled up by developers, or in some cases the city, and replaced by newer, bigger, costlier homes. The greatest demand in the market is for homes valued at less than $250,000. Forces of supply and demand are at play. High demand and low supply are going to drive up values, says County Tax Administrator Marcus Kinraid. The redevelopment is mostly driving up the lot values in residential areas east of downtown, at least 50%, sometimes 100%, sometimes more than 100%. In Quarry Hills, land values spiked 463% due to revaluation. Nearby Carnage neighborhood saw lot values rise 445%, and in College Park, land values increased by 360%. The county is trying to reduce the impact by writing off the increase in building values in cases in which land values have skyrocketed, but the homes themselves haven't been drastically improved. But most of the time, these property owners will pay more anyway. In the aggregate, the revaluation is supposed to be revenue neutral, meaning the revenue brought in would be about the same as it would be had the reappraisal not taken place, at least as a starting point for the county's budget deliberations this year. But revenue neutrality doesn't apply to individual properties, which means that those in rapidly developing neighborhoods will see their tax bills climb, while people in neighborhoods whose values have risen less than 20% will pay less, says County Commissioner Matt Calabria. East Raleigh community activist Octavia Rainey sees the process as another piece of the systemic gentrification of her neighborhood. The tax hikes mean lower-income residents who are ineligible for the senior tax relief will face a difficult decision. Are you going to keep the property, or do you just sell it? For the people who own their houses, they're trying to figure out what to do, Rainey says. East Raleigh is really suffering from this tax increase. You have people who live in the redevelopment areas, and they can't afford to pay their taxes. The city's going to have to deal with that. One idea is to adopt a grant program similar to Durham's, in which longtime residents in revitalizing areas, making below 80% of the area median income, can apply for funding assistance to offset the tax increase. City Council member Nicole Stewart calls the assessment hikes in College Park startling, but I also think not terribly unexpected. We've been hearing community members say this for a long time, that we need to balance the need for affordable housing without putting that burden back on taxpayers, Stewart says. It's going to be a tough, huge balancing act over the next 4 years. And next, Barry Yeoman pens the cover story from the Indie Week this week, 20 Years in Hell. Randy Davis admits he's not a natural warrior. I try to make everybody happy, he says. My nature is to get along. When an industrial hog farm went up near his home in Stantonsburg in 1991, and 4 years later he watched pink wastewater flow toward the creek where he played as a child, even then he shied away from confrontation. It was early in his career, and he didn't want to be seen as a rabble-rouser. If you're too vocal sometimes, he says, things can go sour. He dates his turning point to a crisp sunny day in 2012. Davis and his family were living in his grandparents' old house across the road from where he grew up, on land that straddles Wilson and Greene counties. He and his 8-year-old had been on a father-daughter outing. They arrived home, he says, to an odor that had wafted over from the nearby hog facility, Stantonsburg Farm. Swine operations don't export their odor 24/7. But at its worst, the manure smells like rotten eggs and ammonia, says the federally funded journal Environmental Health Perspectives. It chases people indoors and sticks to clothing, to the point that Davis and his wife no longer hang their laundry outside to dry. When they stepped out of the truck, Davis says, the stink was particularly strong. Dad, why do we have to live like this? He recalls his daughter asking. When I go to my friend's house, I don't smell this smell. That question thwacked Davis. He had grown up swimming and fishing in the nearby sand pits and creeks, and expected his kids to have a footloose childhood, too. When his oldest son, now an adult, was a child, they would pitch tents on their own property and camp overnight. We didn't go to the mountains or wherever, he says. We live in the country. His two younger kids have had a more ambivalent relationship to the outdoors. It's not like we stayed inside with the blinds pulled, he said. But living near Stantonsburg Farm, which has a permit to raise 4,800 pigs at a time, has meant less camping and fishing. The children didn't have birthday parties around the swimming pool because they never knew when the smell would chase everyone inside. That uncertainty, he says, has taken a toll. A man's home is his castle, and he feels he needs to defend his castle, and so it makes you feel weaker, he says. His children have noticed their parents' helplessness, he says, and have internalized it themselves. It makes them not as bold, makes them not as daring, makes them not as willing to challenge. Stantonsburg Farm raises the pigs for the Virginia-based Smithfield Foods, which is owned by a Chinese company. In 2014, Davis signed on as one of more than 500 plaintiffs suing Smithfield's hog production subsidiary, then called Murphy Brown. The 26 lawsuits allege that industrial hog farming makes life intolerable for those living nearby. In legal parlance, that it creates a private nuisance. The plaintiffs live near farms contracted to or owned by Smithfield. They allege the facilities produce a recurring stench and attract flies, buzzards, and late-night truck traffic. The lawsuits claim that Smithfield can control the nuisance by changing how its farmers dispose of the pigs' urine and feces. The waste is currently flushed into large open pits called lagoons, where it sits until growers spray it on their fields as fertilizer. Smithfield insists that the nuisance claims are overblown and that alternative disposal technologies cost too much. From the beginning, the lawsuits have been nothing more than a money grab by the big litigation machine, the company said in a 2018 statement. The company calls these suits a serious threat to a major industry, to North Carolina's entire economy, and to the jobs and livelihoods of tens of thousands of North Carolinians. But the company lost all five federal cases that went to trial in 2018 and 19. Juries awarded 36 neighbors a total of almost $550 million, which the court dialed back to about $98 million because of a North Carolina law limiting punitive damages. Davis's case has not yet gone to trial, but on January 31st in Richmond, the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals will hold oral arguments in the first of Smithfield's appeals. The appellate court decision will help determine whether Davis's lawsuit moves forward, whether he can seek damages for what he calls his children's diminished childhood. The case before the 4th Circuit is called McIver versus Murphy Brown. It involves a rural community in Bladen County and a swine facility that opened in its midst in the mid-1990s. owner Billy Kinlaw had a contract with Smithfield's Murphy Brown subsidiary and a permit to raise more than 14,000 pigs at a time. Like all 26 lawsuits, this one was filed by Wallace and Graham, a Salisbury law firm that often takes on large corporations. The trial took place at the U.S. District Court in Raleigh in April 2018. On the witness stand, Kinlaw's neighbors recounted how the odor, buzzards, flies, and truck traffic upended their lives. "My father was a sharecropper," said plaintiff Daphne McCoy, an administrative assistant. "We didn't have a lot, and what he did leave to his family was that little piece of land." Back then, she said, it was quiet and the air was fresh. You could spend all day on the porch or under the tree, but no one does that anymore. You can ride through, and it looks like a ghost town compared to when I was coming up. Many of McCoy's relatives still live along that road, but McCoy said she fears that when her own children grow up, they'll settle down in less noxious surroundings. "They're embarrassed by the odors," she testified. "They're embarrassed to have their friends over." Like Randy Davis, three counties away, McCoy said she felt frustrated by her inability to give her kids a pastoral North Carolina childhood. "I would like for you to know how helpless I feel as a mother to hear them complain about the kids say, 'Your house smells like a trash dump,'" she told the jury. "I just want you to know how it's sometimes hopeless and helpless it feels." This frustration, argued the plaintiff co-counsel, Michael Keske, was as avoidable as the smell itself. Smithfield has saved untold millions of dollars by refusing to use alternative technology that will fix the problems, he said during his opening argument. He added that Smithfield has tried to evade responsibility for the stench. One of the documents he offered as evidence was a 1999 memo from a now-retired Smithfield executive, Don Butler, lauding the state's new odor regulations. "The rules, as written, are so vague and subjective that enforcement will be difficult," Butler wrote. "This may be to our benefit." Smithfield pushed back against the plaintiff's narrative. "There was never an odor issue raised about the Kinlaw farm before this lawsuit," defense attorney Mark Anderson told the jury. Among his witnesses was Jacqueline Creed Enlow, a neighbor whom the Kinlaws have invited over for oyster roasts and pig pickings. Her children sometimes visit the farm, too, she testified, and feed the resident donkeys. "They wouldn't do that," she said, "if the farm had a strong odor. One daughter is really prissy, and her son has a keen sense of smell, and he would have a meltdown. He can't handle gassy smells." Over 3 weeks, the jury heard from parents and children, scientists and industry leaders, who told contradictory stories of life in swine country. Then the jury delivered a decisive verdict. Not only did Smithfield harm the plaintiffs, but it also committed such egregiously wrongful acts that it deserved to pay punitive damages. The jury awarded the 10 plaintiffs a total of $50.75 million. State law reduced the award to $3.25 million. Smithfield appealed that verdict, saying that senior U.S. District Judge W. Earl Britt committed numerous errors, first among them allowing the jury to consider and award punitive damages despite a lack of sufficient evidence. That's the appeal that the Fourth Circuit will hear on January 31. After the McIver verdict, Billy Kinlaw couldn't understand how his farm, with its clean environmental record in the eyes of state government, could be the source of a multi-million dollar jury award. "Quite frankly, I've lost a lot of respect for the legal system," said Kinlaw, who was not himself sued, in an interview for an article published by the Food and Environmental Reporting Network and The Nation. "I've never had any type of violation, never had any type of write-up, and this is in 24 years, and now all of a sudden I'm a nuisance." The industry said the same thing. As part of the Fourth Circuit appeal, four industry groups argued that the court should consider the fact that state regulators have never cited Kinlaw Farms. Plaintiffs' legal theories do not target rogue operators who flout environmental laws, said an amicus brief filed by the North Carolina Pork Council, North Carolina Farm Bureau Federation, and their national counterparts. They challenge operators who comply with the law and carry out ordinary farming practices. It is no exaggeration to say that a plaintiff win in these lawsuits would subject the everyday activity of all farmers to punitive damages. If Randy Davis's lawsuit makes it to trial, it'll be harder for Smithfield and the industry to make that argument. Stantonsburg Farm, which generates an estimated 12 million gallons of hog waste a year, has received multiple write-ups by regulators over the past quarter century. The first came in January 1995. Prakash Menon was on emergency standby for the State Division of Environmental Management when his beeper interrupted a Saturday afternoon. Menon, an environmental engineer, was summoned to Stantonsburg, where he saw stagnant pink liquid in the ditches lining both sides of a rural road. Bacterial action turns hog waste pink. Several neighbors, including Davis, were there to meet him. The discharge came from Stantonsburg Farm according to a violation notice issued by the state government, and it emptied into Contentnia Creek, where Davis had spent so much of his youth. Contentnia Creek, in turn, flows into the Neuse River. Wastewater of this nature has the potential to deplete dissolved oxygen in the affected water body to a point which is harmful to aquatic life, said a DEM inspection report stemming from the incident. But when Menon showed up at the farm, the manager refused him entry. The engineer had to call the Greene County Sheriff's Office for help. On a follow-up visit, two other DEM employees found dead pigs improperly dumped in a drainage area, half covered with water. During that visit, according to state records, the manager again was, quote, not cooperative. The 1995 incident was one of several noted by regulators, including waste discharges in 1999, 2009, and 2013. All the while, neighbors continued to complain. How would you feel if you couldn't drink the water from your own well, go to church without the smell of hog waste permeating your clothing, or even have a barbecue with friends on your own property, said Don Webb, a plaintiff and former hog farmer, in a 2014 statement released by the Waterkeeper Alliance, an environmental group. Webb died in 2018. Stantonsburg Farm is owned by Murphy Family Ventures, a company founded and headed by Wendell Dell Murphy, Jr. He's the son of Wendell Murphy, Sr., who pioneered the expansion of North Carolina's swine industry and also served in the state legislature from 1983 to 93. As the News and Observer chronicled in Boss Hog, its 1995 Pulitzer-winning investigation, the elder Murphy and his legislative allies championed laws to protect the industry, including sales tax exemptions and restrictions on zoning, county zoning powers. Smithfield's subsidiary, Murphy Brown, leased and managed Stantonsburg Farm from 2002 to 2012. Smithfield declined an interview request for this article and declined to answer questions by email. Representatives of Murphy Family Ventures and Stantonsburg Farm did not return phone calls. In its formal response to the lawsuit, Smithfield's acknowledged, quote, a few instances where application of effluent at the Stantonsburg Farm resulted in runoff onto neighboring land and waterways. The company added that the farm and its owners undertook efforts immediately to remediate any runoff and that Smithfield has worked with the farm to minimize the smell and generally improve its environmental performance. Over the past 3 years, Davis says he's noticed a change. The hog operation has been very minimal nuisance. He wonders if this is a result of the lawsuit. The relief has brought Davis little comfort. Some people say, well, aren't you happy about that? Well, no, that made me mad as hell. To him, the improvement shows that Stantonsburg Farm could have mitigated the odors all along, but it cost pennies more to do it, where you can be a better neighbor versus you don't give a crap about your neighbor. The last 3 years of my life living here has been great, he says. The prior 20 years, it was hell. Culture Now. Music section, a column this time by David Ford Smith. Lord of the Trance. Armin van Buuren changed the streaming internet. In 2001, nearly 10 years before Femi Adeyemi's taste-making internet radio network, NTS, alongside outlets like Rinse FM and Red Bull Music Academy, ushered in the reign of curated 2010s web radio, van Buuren created his own radio empire. A fledgling DJ with an effusive, preternaturally positive personality, he wanted to capitalize on the nascent internet boom and to broadcast some of the music he was releasing and enjoying. That May, he hosted the first episode of Into Trance, later dubbed A State of Trance, on Dutch radio. From these humble beginnings, ASOT evolved into a sprawling network of shows and one of the longest, most streamed internet music properties to date, now closing in on 1,000 episodes. In 2019, an average episode of ASOT racked up several hundred thousand views on any individual streaming platform. And one of Van Buuren's recent cuts as a producer, blah, 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 is pushing 400 million views on YouTube. Call him the Alan Freed of trance music. Next month, we are celebrating episode 950 in Utrecht, and it's sold out, Van Buuren says by phone in advance of the U.S. tour that brings him to the Ritz in Raleigh on January 26th. 35,000 tickets, which makes it the world's largest indoor trance event, which I'm super proud of. Van Buuren's wide reach might sound shocking if you've never heard of him or his genre. Think of it this way. If recent superstars like Marshmallow represent the top 40 crossover moment of dance music, trance is like that scene's classic rock, dense, soaring populist music rooted in calls to emotion, larger-than-life ASMR triggers, and utopian hedonism. With a spirit of radical acceptance, and melodies you could hum in the shower. As with many arena rock bands of yore, this kind of fan-based pluralism means that the trance scene seems cheesy and unfashionable at times, absolutely detestable to some dance heads, like the sonic equivalent of a sentimental Lifetime movie strapped to a repetitive 4/4 beat. But that same heart-on-sleeve candor and absence of cool guy expectation has helped keep trance a staple for decades, as other trendier microgenres have died off. Trance's maximalist playbook was folded into the commercial EDM boom of the 2010s. The soaring, melancholy frontline vocals that culminate in a tear-jerking drop, as heard in Aughties trance hits like Motorcycles' As the Rush Comes, would later be retrofitted for massive EDM singles like Zedd's Clarity and Porter Robinson's Divinity. And you can hear trance permutated in trendy 2010s EDM subgenres like Future Bass and Tropical House. Van Buuren laughs when I ask what it's like to be a trance icon in 2020. The downside of what I do is that my genre is definitely not the most popular music right now, he says, but I like it where it is right now. It has its own fan base that's incredibly loyal, and you see a massive trend right now that a lot of techno guys are flirting with trance. This man pays attention. Despite the stereotype of multimillionaire DJs as pretty faces on empty vessels, Van Buuren comes across as a passionate, smart conversationalist, and he is fierce on his causes. We talk about the currently raging Australian wildfires and recent headlines that suggest countless millions of animals have died since they began. Others of his status might use politician tricks to talk around the issue. He says, "You cannot turn away from the gravity of climate change. It's happening, and it's affecting the lives of many people and animals. There's no denying it." Van Buuren recently became a celebrity ambassador for the World Wildlife Fund, which he ascribes to being a father of two and to more general existential concerns about using his massive social media platform for good. One of my main concerns that caused me to get involved with WWF is plastic pollution, he says. It's not limited to one country or territory. It's a global issue that affects us all. He mentions a recent ecological study by the WWF that suggests that we consume a credit card size amount of microplastic every week, primarily through bottled and tap water sources. So clearly, Van Buren's passions extend beyond music, and, as you might expect from someone famous for curating a radio show, his musical tastes extend beyond trance. On his latest record, Balance, he tapped Inner City, better known as Detroit techno pioneer Kevin Saunderson, to appear. I couldn't be more proud that one of my absolute heroes is featured on my album, Van Buren says. He's one of my favorite DJs of all time. Unbridled enthusiasm has been Van Buren's secret weapon for staying safe and sane these last three decades. I'm really lucky to be a nerd, he says. When I started in this industry, I was always more of a nerd than the guy who wants to get crazy and party. I was never into hard drugs. My primary bad habit is wine and champagne, but even now I stay away from things like vodka. Countless EDM festival circuits acts see their stars ascend, only to utterly vanish in a haze of drugs and ego. Van Buren's success story is a useful one. Discipline is crucial to longevity, even in a musical world known for decadent fantasy. Let's talk about food. Food and drink. Nick Williams' column today talks about the new Deli Edison. A bagel of real virtue is almost an unattainable quarry in the South. Like most people who find beauty in this rare beast, I have ironclad ideas on what bagels should and should not be. I was thrilled to discover that the bagels at Deli Edison come fairly close to my personal archetype. Their shiny, lacquered crusts yield an audible crackle, and the interiors balance heft and chewy density with a soft, toothsome crumb. They fight back, just not too hard. Of course, if you ask Sam Suchoff, there's no such thing as a perfect bagel. I've eaten somewhere around 500,000 bagels in my life, Suchoff explains. I tend to stop listening when someone tries to explain to me what a real bagel is. It's food, it's culture, it's memory, it's sustenance, it's complicated. Deli Edison, which opened in December, is the latest project from animal welfare certified ham mastermind Suchoff and his partners Pete Wagner and Dan Obusan. Suchoff is also the chef and owner of the barbecue restaurant, The Pig, and the neighborhood bar. The three businesses share a parking lot with a karate dojo and a dry cleaner in a tidy little shopping center on Weaver Dairy Road. Speaking of archetypes, the woodsy, semi-suburban setting might be the only thing keeping Deli Edison from achieving its own state of platonic idealism. Delis are unavoidable in our nation's more walkable cities, where they range in quality from dubious purveyors of cut-rate survival calories to temples of worship for cultish sandwich devotees, often with an imperceptible line separating the two. But that kind of deli, you know, the New York kind, is a relative newcomer to our firmly automotive commuter scene, and the ones that have popped up recently are still finding their footing with Southern diners who aren't accustomed to a stop at the corner familiar as part of their daily routine. Of these welcome and ambitious establishments like Durham's Lucky's Deli and Carborough's Neil's Deli, Deli Edison is perhaps the most self-assured, with an admirable commitment to its own charmingly askew approach. Delis tend to be free-form, Wagner says. We don't have to stick to a single concept, A deli can be quick, but still have a bit of the old roozle-doozle. Case in point, the Piedmont, a study in whatever the hell roozle-doozle is a breakfast sandwich that will surely haunt my dreams until I can once again cram one into my face. It's a hunk of sage-tinged breakfast sausage nestled between a layer of melted provolone and another of fluffy grilled egg. But what elevates it into classic level territory, the kind of thing you eat as a high schooler, only to spend a college lamenting its unavailability, is a smear of cream cheese infused with house-made njuja, a whipped, spreadable salami of enchanting piquancy. I had mine on a toasted everything bagel, and at 8 a.m. on a freezing Monday, let me tell you, it was wild, wild times. The lunch menu has its own left-of-center concoctions. The nonna is a hoagie stuffed with unctuous, herb-flecked porchetta, pickled vegetables, and roasted broccoli rib, contributing tangy and bitter offsets to the satisfyingly greasy pork. One of the heartiest sandwiches comes adorned with slabs of barbecue-glazed Impossible Meatloaf, a fairly stupendous simulacrum of the real thing, made in-house with fake meat and love, according to Wagner. It's a feat of vegetarian legerdemain. We wanted to create an equal experience, Obusan says, not just a good vegan sandwich, but a good sandwich, period. And have no fear, if you're looking for more conventional deli stuff, like an inviting refrigerated case stocked with salads and prepared foods. The smoked whitefish is meatier than creamy, a rejoinder to the sad and sodden fish salads of the world. The egg salad is similarly addictive, airy, tangy, and electrified with fresh dill. I hoped to close out my visit to Deli Edison with a staple black and white cookie, teased on the website, but sadly nowhere to be found. I did, however, indulge in a frisbee-sized ginger snap made with bacon fat. Its flavor and texture were a genuinely new experience for me, crumbling into smoky, melty cookie molecules the moment it hit my tongue. I can't imagine a more appropriate closing statement from a southern deli, especially one with roots so inextricably entwined with local sustainable pork. Some people may not need bacon fat in their confectionery. I'm no longer one of those people. And I have time for a portion of the music review by Tomasi McDonald of the Body Eclectic. Black Femmes take over hip-hop with The Conjure and Be Connected in Durham. Throughout history, from the mythic mammy figure and the Hottentot Venus to Serena Williams and Beyoncé, the black woman's anatomy has been a landscape where mainstream culture has projected its worst fears, stereotypes, abuses, sexist tropes, gender controls, and fantasies. On January 24th, We Rhyme Too, a Black Femmes hip-hop showcase at Local 506, will be an affirming reclamation of the black woman's voice, independence, spirit, and perhaps most important, her body. For me, it's necessary to reclaim and govern our own culture, says Angel Dozier, one of the organizers. I grew up in empowering MCs and hip-hop pioneers like Sharock and Roxanne Shanté. All the Roxannes! It's how I grounded myself in my personal education. It's how I serve as an educational practitioner for our community. We Rhyme Too is presented by the Be Connected Durham and The Conjure, which also presented her story, A Night of Black Femmes in Hip-Hop, at the Pinhook in November. That night offered a remarkable look at the creative energies of young black women. The room was filled to capacity with a cross-section of the city, all ages, races and genders, gay, straight, non-binary, different socioeconomic backgrounds. There were some badass sisters in-house, starting with the MC, Dozier, who works as the publicist for North Carolina's poet laureate Jackie Shelton Green. While introducing the artist, Dozier reminded us to protect and pay transgender black femmes. The show's curator, Rachel Alexis Storer, is known in the entertainment arena as DJ Gemini. Gemini told the Indy that hip-hop has been very much a boys' club and that most hip-hop show may include one woman, but are very much cishet male-dominated. Gemini is also behind The Conjure with its rallying cry of pay black femmes. It was important for men, women, and non-binary folks to be there supporting black femmes, being in the audience, making sure we get paid, Gemini says. Anytime you see a black woman on this stage, know this, they're getting paid, Dozier adds. She encouraged us to purchase The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause from a vending booth that was set up by the city's near-iconic activists, Omissad Bernie Scott. Mikaisa Thompson drew attention with her mobile thrift store. In the case of listening to revolutionary words, well, black, Thompson was charged by police in May after her white neighbors in Garner complained she was playing her recordings of Malcolm X's speeches too loud. She's back there creating legacies for black women, Dozier said, reminding us that Thompson is the mother of Takiya Thompson, the NCCU student who toppled the Confederate statue in Durham. The crowd was treated to a striking palette of hip-hop styles by 9 artists. The Possibilities of Love and Love Gone Wrong, commentaries on race, immigration, black-on-black violence, motherhood, teaching, and humor. Ronita Stewart, who works with special needs children in Chapel Hill Carborough Schools and also sings professionally, arrived just before showtime to support her younger co-worker, Exhale, who was first up. Her stream of consciousness flow was comparable to the Beat Generation poets of the 1940s and 50s. We have to stop here. Unfortunately, this issue of Indie Week will be available on our website as a podcast after the initial airing. Reading for our blind and hearing-impaired listeners, for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, this is John Federson, formerly known as John Federson. So long, and see you next week.